Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, this is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar. And if you're a guitar player who's looking to make some more money, then listen very closely to what I'm about to tell you. If you're a guitar player or any other kind of musician for that matter, or if you know a musician who wants to make some more money without having to tour or go on the road or put up with any of the other BS musicians normally have to deal with, then you need to download this new special report about how to make a small fortune by licensing your music. And by licensing music, I mean getting your music inserted into movies, television shows, and commercials. The report is less than 20 pages long, and it was written by Mike Elsner, who I interviewed in episode number 167 of this show. Mike's been doing this for over 14 years, and he's had over 2,000 songs licensed at this point in time. That means he's getting paid to license almost 150 songs per year. Now, keep in mind, most successful career musicians don't get paid for 150 songs in total over a 30 or 40 year career. Yet Mike's getting paid for this on an annual basis. And the cool thing about this business is that you can run it from your own home studio and you'll never have to deal with ivory tower record label executives telling you what to play and how to play it, and no shady managers or unethical business people telling you what to do either. So download Mike's free ebook on the 4-step plan to licensing success right now. Just go to everyonelovesguitar.com/Mike. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/Mike, M-I-K-E. Let me know how you like the book. And now let's get on with the show. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber with Everyone Loves Guitar. And I'm with Mike Lent. Mike's a session musician in L.A. And he's toured and recorded with loads of artists, including Barry Manilow, Jeffrey Osborne, Marie Osmond, Ricky Martin, Ronnie Laws, Patty Austin, Al Jardine from the Beach Boys, Steve Miller, Babyface, Donna Summer, David Foster, Carney and Wendy Wilson, and Grover Washington Jr., just to name a few. As a session musician in L.A., his credits include Grace Under Fire, WKRP in Cincinnati, I always say that weird, Ally McBeal, and Walker, Texas Ranger. He's composed music for shows like ABC's General Hospital and Port Charles, NBC's California Dreams, and Sweating Bullets for CBS. In addition, Mike's played guitar for national tours of Broadway shows like Mamma Mia, Rent, Aida. Did I pronounce that right?
Aida.
I knew I didn't. Thank you. Chicago, 42nd Street, and The Lion King. And Mike's been performing with Barry Manilow since 1997, which is a really long time. His TV appearances include The Today Show, Good Morning America, CBS This Morning, Tonight Show, Conan, Rachel Ray, Martha Stewart, Jimmy Kimmel, Ellen DeGeneres, Larry King, The Wendy Williams Show, The Late Show with Craig Ferguson, and Dancing with the Stars. Mike's origins in music were he started studying piano at age 7, started playing guitar at age 10, and at 15 he started working as a professional guitarist, performing in clubs and concerts through his high school years in Pacific Grove, California. Upon graduation, he attended Berklee College of Music in Boston. Mike, I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Craig. My pleasure.
Hey, you grew up in Pacific Grove, California, and I was curious, when you finished high school, you moved across the country to go to Berklee, and there's a lot of music schools between Pacific Grove and Boston. I was curious what prompted you to do that, make a move like that. It's a pretty big commitment.
It was, but I think at that point, that was in the 70s, 1977 is when I graduated from high school. And there were just a few places that if you're really serious about jazz and pursuing a professional career in music, it was Berklee, maybe University of Miami and North Texas State, and also Cal State Northridge had a really good jazz program at that point. So there were – it was a kind of a small handful of places that were really right for me. And I think by the time I was ending my junior year into my senior year of high school, I was pretty clear that that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah, and you didn't
–
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I'm saying you're comfortable. That's a not only like distance wise, but like, you know, I would imagine the culture of the Northeast is probably different than where you're at in California.
Well, it is, but actually, I landed in Pacific Grove, California after having lived in Southern California and in the East Coast, I'd actually, my father was from Massachusetts, so not far from Boston.
Okay.
And so I did have, and he was actually back there at that time too. He lives on the East Coast. He's in New Hampshire and lives in Maine. I lived there until right before high school. Then I moved out here. So, so I did have my father out there. I was close to him. And, you know, there were other people that did it too. I had friends from California that were going to Berkeley also. Some of my best friends there were also just kind of on their own in, Boston, you know, LA, California guys. And, so, and people went there from all over the world. A lot of my friends were from Japan, from Germany. It's very, very international. So it was an interesting place to go to be at that time.
Yeah, man. What was the? Are you still in touch with some of your classmates there, and or did you hang out with any players that some of the listeners might know?
Yeah, one of the first guys I met was Eric Marienthal. He was a great alto and tenor saxophone player, actually plays it all, but he was in Chicoria's band for a long time. Of course, has a great solo career. Eric, I went back there. I remember in the dorms in Berkeley, they're actually upstairs from some of the classrooms, and way in the basement, they had these rooms where they're called session rooms. They're basically rehearsal rooms, but they would always say, "Oh, I'm doing a session," but doing a session didn't mean you're going to do a recording session. It meant you're going to go play jazz with some guys down there. So I was wandering around the halls, probably my first night. And you kind of come up to the window and you can look in and you can hear these guys playing. And I heard this one group of guys playing and I went, wow, these Boston guys are really good. And of course, one of them was Eric Marienthal, who was from LA. He was starting the same time I was, and it just happened that he's one of the best players anywhere. And certainly a world-class player to this day. But Eric was one of the first guys I met. I still see him occasionally. We do things here and there. There was at that point a vibes player named Hendrik Merkens, who I've kept in touch with, who is pretty well known in New York, does a lot of Brazilian music and also plays chromatic harmonica. And he's someone I've kept in touch with, and a few guys. Oh, and let's see, who else? I'll think of some other players. There are a few guys that I keep in touch with. So
that's cool. So you developed a nice network of friends there, basically.
I do. Oh, I know who I was thinking of. Tom Gimbel, who is in Foreigner. And he's someone that I just saw last year, went and saw Foreigner. He's been with Foreigner for about 20 years, plays sax and guitar and sings. And he's had an interesting career. We were kind of best friends toward the end of the time that I was in Berkeley. And he went on to play offstage keyboard, sax, and some vocals with Aerosmith for years and years.
Wow.
So kind of this big rock gig where he wasn't actually, you know, on stage. And then he went from there to Foreigner. So, and where he's very featured and on stage, and he's been doing that for a long time. So he's someone that was a good friend of mine at Berkeley also.
Is that a 2-year program, Berkeley?
It's a 4-year program, but most of the people that I knew didn't hang out the whole time. For me, it was 3 semesters. The same with Eric. We did 3 semesters and then kind of, went other places. I ended up going back to LA after that and going to Cal State Northridge and auditioning for the A band there, which is their best big band, jazz band in the program. And met a lot of people there who still are in the studios in LA. And so that was, a good educational thing, too.
So Cal State Northridge, what came after that? Did you go right into session work or?
Well, I was there for a while. I started to work in L.A., and I was really young at that point. You know, I was 20 years old, and, you know, I really expected things to happen very fast. I met some really good players. I saw a lot of music. I got to know a lot of the people that were, working in LA and got to play with a fair amount of them. I got a lot of experience, but I think, after a couple of years of being there, I got some offers back up in Northern California. I really wasn't probably ready for a full-on studio career in LA. So I went back up to Northern California and it it turned into a really busy time where I was playing a lot. I got a lot of experience. It's a smaller area, but has a lot of good musicians. And I was able to get into something where I was playing 6-7 nights a week, popular groups, you know, people lining up around the block to see us play and playing our own music. And that gave me, you know, really a long period of time where I was getting just a lot of playing experience that you don't necessarily get in a place like LA, where you're kind of going from one thing to a really different thing to something else. And it's great, but you don't get that just playing with the same guys all the time thing very often in a place like LA. So by the time I went back to LA in the late 80s, I really was completely ready to kind of dive in and do everything that I ended up doing. So
it's interesting that you were playing your own music at that young of an age. That's a pretty cool thing. Not many people get to do that.
No, it was a great experience. It really was. You know, we were producing our own records, and so I got a start with production and engineering and that kind of thing at a pretty young age. And that's something I'm still very involved in. So it was great. Yeah, it was a great time.
Very cool, man. Hey, I want to ask you about some of the artists you've played with, and maybe for each of these folks, you could tell me, share with us how you got the gig and the nature of what the work was, and if you have any cool stories about working with them. The first would be Jeffrey Osborne.
Yeah, Jeffrey. Jeffrey's a great R&B singer, great pop singer, just a great singer in general. And he'd been someone who I had always really noticed and had been a big fan of. I can remember, you know, kind of driving around this area at one point and hearing, I think it was On the Wings of Love or something, and kind of trying to sing along with it. And I remember this very clearly, going, you know what? I am just, that's a singer and I'm not a singer. And I loved his solo albums. He'd been with LTD and done, hits like Back in Love and things like that. And, I knew of his solo work, and I was a big fan of those records that he did with George Duke. And I had moved back to L.A., and one of my good friends who had moved down from this area and done very well is a bass player named Larry Antonino. And his wife
– Wait a minute. Is he playing with Pablo Cruz?
He is.
Holy shit. Oh my God. Small world. This is so nutty. Do you know who Rich Herring is?
I don't think so.
Okay. No. Rich plays lead guitar for Little River Band. Wow. This is so bizarre, man. So Rich is a guy who lives in Nashville. I interviewed him. They were playing down here in Tampa, and he said, Craig, do you want some tickets? So he gave my wife and I a couple of tickets to come see him play. Great concert. Pablo Cruz opens up. And I'm like, wow, that bass player, you know, to me, I mean, the band sounded great, but musically, he was the highlight. So they're breaking down the set at the end, and I walked over to him because he gave us some pretty good tickets, and I just walked over there, and I said, hey, how you doing? I gave him my card. I said, I'd love to interview you. And I was like, this was not too long ago. You know, the guy hasn't called me or anything, but I remember him. Wow, what are the odds, man?
I'll tell him to call you.
Tell him to call me.
He's had a great career. He's done a lot of great stuff. And we go back as far as he can go almost. He was the first time Larry ever moved out of his parents' house. He moved in with me, and I had talked him into quitting the band that he was in and joining a band that I was in. He grew up about 40 minutes away in Santa Cruz, California. And I grew up here, of course, on the Monterey Peninsula. And so I was in a band, he was in a band, and we started playing then. But he was, he moved down to L.A. before I did. I had been down there before, but I was still up in Monterey at that time. When I moved back down, he, of course, was one of my best friends at that point and has been, forever. So his wife had heard that there was an audition for Jeffrey Osborne. So I wanted to get in on that. I kind of had to, find out some information, do a little detective work and find out where the management office was, drop off a tape, some house in Beverly Hills. And
sounds like a drug deal,
I certainly wasn't invited to audition, put it that way. You know, yeah. I'd been you know, I wasn't known. You know, I knew players and I'd done some things, but, you know, I hadn't done, you know, I wasn't one of the guys that's going to get a call for it. So I was, you know, I got a call and I was able to do it. And it was at a, this was the first really big kind of audition scene that I'd been through. And really one of the only ones that I've seen like that. They had a rehearsal studio in the Valley booked for about a week. And every day, starting on Monday, every half an hour or so, they'd have a new full band come in. They were replacing everyone. So they had a keyboard player, keyboard two, because the musical director had already been hired. Keyboard two, percussion, drums, bass, and guitar were all being auditioned. So every half an hour, a whole group of these guys would come in and play as a group. And we were told to learn, you know, four or five songs. So they'd rehearse them. All these guys, everyone in L.A. was outside. You know, guys from Tower of Power, guys, a lot of guys that I knew. All kinds of players and, you know, great bass players, great keyboard players, everything. So, you know, I came in and did my audition. They did callbacks on a Friday. I got called to do a callback, came back, and then I think late Saturday night I got a call offering me the gig. So that was it was a big deal. I think a big part of it for me being ready for that is I was super prepared for it. I really studied the songs. I really learned the songs. I learned all the parts that were on the record. And I was also a fan, so it wasn't hard to kind of pretend that I was into the music, as I was. And I still work with Jeffrey. I worked with Jeffrey for 7 straight years, from 1990 to 1997. 97, I started doing Barry Manilow, and I was able to do the gigs with both those people for about a year. And then I kind of had to, you know, make a choice about what I was doing. Barry's was a pretty big gig. We were working more at the time, doing, you know, big tours. And I kind of had to, you know, take off from Jeffrey at that point. But we've kept in great touch. A couple of years ago, I did another tour. It actually was Al Jarreau's last tour. They were doing a co-headliner thing with Jeffrey. And it's still great. You know, so it's been many years that I've been working on and off with Jeffrey, and one of the great singers. I've never heard him sing a bad note in 28 years or whatever it is. And one of the greatest guys. And it really opened up a lot of doors for me. After that, that's when I started to get session work, because the people that I was playing with, it kind of, you know, people started calling me because they'd seen the band or they'd heard that I was doing it, and it kind of really opened a lot of doors for me. So it was a great thing.
Well, one thing that's really interesting is that you've had these musical relationships for a really long time. And that's not really that common.
Yeah, I think, you know, there are a group of us that kind of grew up around the same time. When I was, you know, teenager into my early 20s, I was always playing with the guys that were a lot older. And they were really in a different generation, and they influenced me and gave me, you know, kind of an idea of what you could do as a musician. So they were definitely role models, both good and bad, I think, on how to become a musician and what kind of careers you can have. So I had this idea that, you know, being a studio musician and touring were the things that I really wanted to do. And I got that from older guys. But then there was a group of people that were more like around my age. And that would be Larry Antonino, guys like Shem.
Yeah.
We talked about Shem Bunchrek, and now with Toto. He's one of those guys around the same age.
Yeah.
And so there are a group of us that have known each other now for a really long time. And we've done a lot of gigs together, and we've done tours together, a lot of sessions and all these things. And most importantly, we've been friends for a long time. And I think that's really an important thing. It's the best thing you can do as a musician, to make good friendships with people that you have a lot in common with musically.
Yeah. But I mean, to have this longevity, I mean, it's probably a function of both you and the actual performer, because you know, as far as I've seen, like people are constantly changing out. You know, they get a new producer. Okay, time to clear house. You know, oh, let's have all women in the band, or oh, let's have all young guys in the band. And you know, I think it's great that for whatever reason, man, you've been able to. You know, I think it just says a lot about both you and obviously the relationship you have with these people, but the stability of the people that you're working for, like Barry and Jeffrey. You know.
Well, that has been a fortunate thing, and I think that that's becoming more and more rare in the industry in general. I think if you come up with someone who's become a star in the last 4 or 5 years, you know, the chances of them having a 30 or 40 year career are not probably as good as they were when Jeffrey and Barry were coming up. So,
oh yeah, it's like being in the NFL, man. It's like 3 or 4 years.
It is. It's a short-term thing, and you don't, you know, they don't get the support from the record company. There are a lot of things. There are a lot of factors. That being said, there's a lot to kind of holding on to a gig. I think there are a few of us in Barry's band that have been there a long time. There's one guy that's been there longer than I have. There's one guy that's been there almost as long as I have, and I'm kind of the second longest in tenure, and we, have this little ongoing thing where we call ourselves the survivors, because we've seen people come and go, but there are a few of us that have been there, and kind of when changes have been made, we've been able to kind of stay in there and be a part of Barry's long-term thing. So, and a lot goes into that. I think, it has to do with having good relationships with the artists, and and that's, there's a certain art to that. I think, I think there's a certain art to being, close enough with the artist so that he's comfortable knowing that he can ask you for anything, that you're not going to be offended if he asks you to play something different than what you're playing, and, you know, being able to give him what he needs on night to night, always kind of showing up, always having the enthusiasm, yeah. Things like that. And getting along well with the people you're working with, getting along well with the crew. When I, when it came to, you know, I was, by the time 1997 came around and I was asked to, come audition for Barry. And that was a much smaller thing. That was a handful of guys. That wasn't the kind of cattle call that I'd been through before. That was maybe 3 or 4 guys got called. And went over to the music director's house and kind of just read through the book. And then I was asked to do that. But I'd been recommended by some people, and some of the people that I'd been recommended by were crew guys that I'd worked with on tours with Jeffrey and other people. You know, yeah, he's easy to work with. So it's important to get along with the crew and the management, all those things. And some people don't do that as well as others. And they don't last on gigs for reasons that really don't necessarily have anything to do with how great they are as musicians.
You know what I think is interesting? You said that you got recommended by the crew. I think, like, I've always been the kind of person, I'm fortunate that, you know, I grew up in a blue-collar household, but I went to school and I became a CPA. And when I started my career, I was the kind of guy, like, I could talk to the CFO and then I could talk to the guy that was cleaning his office at night, yeah. You know, and I never looked at any of them differently. And I think that in the music business, obviously or clearly, is really important, you know, because some people might have, you know, thumbed their nose up to a crew member for, I don't know why, but I'm just saying, you know, like, oh, well, he's, you know, there are certain people that treat the people that are paying them one way and everybody else a different way. And there are certain people that just treat everybody the same.
Right.
You know,
that's true. And it's possible. It happens on tours because you have different travel schedules, because you're spending more time with certain people than others. And on big tours, when you have the crew and the band, you know, there can be a separation and things. I've seen things get dicey in those relationships. So it's, you know, it's important to be able to kind of get along with people across the board, make sure you're taking care of everything that you need to do to be professional. Certainly, I'm very involved in making sure all my guitars are set up and, you know, the amps are sounding the way I want them to and all that. You can take your what you do seriously, but still, you know, be respectful of everyone that you're working with, and that's important.
Yeah, that's really cool. I have to ask you, I want to talk about Barry, but man, I got to just ask you, you work with Steve Miller for a little bit. I think you did some studio work for him.
Well, yeah, actually, it was a very short thing, but very cool. And this goes back to working with Al Jardine. Al Jardine, original Beach Boy, great guy, lives in Big Sur, which I know you don't know a lot about California, but Big Sur is about 26 miles south of where I am in Carmel. And it's this beautiful kind of right on the coast on these big rolling hills, small town, not even really a town. It's just kind of a little area. And he came up here, I think in the 70s, at the kind of peak of Beach Boys fame and fortune, and bought a bunch of land, built a studio in one of the existing, I think it was the original town hall in Big Sur. Anyway.
Wow. That's a lot of money to come in and do something like that.
Yeah. So it's called the Red Barn. And Al did a solo record, I think it came out in about 2010. And so I got called to do that. And it was just one of the best projects. It was really like, you know, kind of like the way they used to do albums in the 70s and the 60s, where you go down and everyone's together and you're kind of working for days and days, weeks and weeks, you know, making a record. And he had the guests he had on the record were, you know, Neil Young, you know, Flea played bass on some stuff, and Steve Miller, the guys from America, and Glenn Campbell is one of Glenn Campbell's, you know, toward the end of his recording career. And, you know, I got to play on tracks with him and that kind of thing. But some of those guys, like, they went to Neil Young's house to record his stuff. So I played on tracks, and he was in the headphones with me when I was, you know, singing with him and playing with him, which is great. But we weren't in the studio at the same time. And that's kind of the typical way that most things are these days. But with Steve, he came down and basically spent a full day down there. And the way the studio set up, there's a big room where the drums were, the big grand piano. I'm not sure if we had organ or something else in there. Vocals were done in there. And then there's the control room. And then right off the control room, there's this room that's the guitar room. And just to tell you a little bit about that, it's got, if you look up in this room, there's this kind of shelf, and you see all these guitars and guitar necks sticking out of there. And it's pretty much every guitar that was ever used on a Beach Boys record. I mean, you pull these things out, you pull a case out, and it's the 12 string that they played on California Girls in the original recording.
Wow.
You know, this is the bass that was on all the 70s recordings. You know, it's amazing. So that's in there, and all these amps that they have in there. So Steve Miller is in the room with me, and we've got a chart for this, and we're doing a remake basically of Help Me Rhonda, which Al had was the original singer on with the Beach Boys, and this was a version that Steve Miller and Al were going to sing together. So Steve is you know, great guitar player, has been playing forever, but he's not a reader. So part of what I did was teaching him the song, which was so cool. And he was just the coolest guy. So we, you know, we're in there and we're kind of working, you know, picking guitars, picking amps. He had his own guitar. He had this little kind of, I think it was a Fender that he had helped design that was very light and kind of all set up for his specs. But he had that, but then we were kind of picking and choosing, you know, old Fenders that were in there. So we pick guitars. And
what did you wind up picking, if you remember?
I think, Al has an old Fender Strat. I'm not even sure what year it is. It's an old white one, and it's kind of. And I played it on a lot of that record. I think on this one, I ended up on this song, I ended up playing one of my guitars. I have kind of a Charvel custom shop Strat that I ended up playing on that. I think we played through a Fender Deluxe or something.
Like an original?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
So it was great stuff. So we recorded, had a great time, recorded a rhythm track, and took our time with it. It was kind of, I remember being a long thing, and we'd go and listen in the room, and Steve was just, great to hang with. We're sitting there, talking about stuff. Well, let's change this, let's change that. And then I remember it came time for him to do his vocal, and Al said, okay, well, let's, now we want to do your vocal. And Steve said, okay, I'll be ready in 17 minutes.
Not 16, and not 18.
And I was like, well, what do you mean? We're ready for you now. And he goes, no, I don't sing. And I have a vocal exercise that I do before I sing anything. And he has he got out this whole tape on his computer that he sing his warm-up exercises. And he will not sing a note until he does that. And he does the whole thing. He's been doing it for a long time. And it's just very disciplined and very impressive. He did that. He's completely ready when he's done with that. Sang great, played harmonica on it. We did a whole video. There's some video on YouTube of this whole making of that. It was pretty fun.
What's it called, man? That'd be worth looking at. The making of Al Jardine?
Yeah, it's I think there's a link on Al Jardine's website, and it's a Help Me Rhonda video. So that was it. I didn't, I was never in Steve's band, but I had a great time working with him. And at the end of the session, somehow he had gotten a ride down there and didn't have a ride back. So I ended up driving him the, 45 minutes back home and just talking and having a great time. So it was definitely a great hang.
That's really cool, man. Very cool. Now talk about Barry, because you've been with Barry, I think, 21 years?
21 years, yeah.
That's longer than most marriages would ever last. You know that, right?
I do. It is a long time. I thought it was, I was coming up on 20 years and I thought, oh no, there's no way this can be 20 years. it's been great. And as I said, some of the other guys have been there a long time. Most of the people in the band have been there about 14 or 15 years now. It's been pretty stable since then. And so those, it's been great. Barry is an amazing artist. He's had just an amazing career. I mean, right from the beginning, he started out, being an arranger and a producer in New York and the jingle scene and the record scene and all that in the early 70s, and was very respected in that scene. A lot of people that I've run into in New York over the years go, oh, yeah, I remember Barry from when he was, writing jingles and this and that, and used to work with him. And he was always a real musician. And he's always kept that. But his career took a turn. He kind of unexpectedly became a huge breakout star in the mid-70s. And he had been doing it quite a while before I came along. But I had known people that worked with him before. I'd known John Ferraro was his drummer for a long time. And I knew that it was a serious gig. I knew that it was not just some kind of lightweight pop gig that maybe some people thought it was. And it's not at all. He's a very serious musician. It's very demanding. He's recorded every style of music that you can possibly imagine with all the best players. So when he did a jazz album, it had Mondell Lowe and all the great players on it. When he does pop records, he's got Tom Scott and all the top LA guys playing his records. And so he doesn't, it's not okay to just kind of be good at one thing and play with Barry. It's not going to work. You have to be able to read. You have to be able to kind of, adapt to whatever it is that you're doing that day. And it could be anything. But the guys in the band are, besides being some of my really probably my best friends in the world after this long, are such good players that we rely on each other so much, and we have such confidence in each other that it's really a special situation. As you pointed out, there aren't that many situations in music where you could be together with a group for this long and, still be doing it and still, feel great about it, still be excited about the music from night to night. He mixes it up. He's got a certain number of hits that, of course, he's got to do every night, But even those change over, you know, the months and years. You know, we have different arrangements of them. It's always changing, and we have hundreds and hundreds of songs that we've learned and rehearsed with him over the years. They're part of his catalog. So, it's been a special thing. The guys in the band are great. He's amazing to work with. He's inspiring. He's tireless. And he's still going strong. And, we took a little time off about a year and a half ago where he really kind of took a break for about 9 months, which is longer than he had for a really long time. And he came back out of that just really ready to go and anxious to keep performing. And so we've been going out. We just did a run through Florida.
You were down here?
Yeah, we played in Sarasota and Fort Myers and Jacksonville and Hollywood. So,
do you do records with him as well as touring?
I do.
You do?
Yeah.
When he records, a guy like him who's such a good songwriter and who is not a newbie in the studio, I mean, he knows what to do. Does he produce his own albums, or is there a producer? And if there's a producer, does a producer really tell Barry, well, you need to change this up?
That's an interesting question. I've done probably about 9 records with Barry over the years, and they're all a little different, but ultimately Barry's the music director in the studio. He's the real producer. He's the one that has to be happy with it, but he does have producers that work with him. You know, we've had famous producers. Phil Ramone did one that was an amazing experience. We've done the big recording sessions at Capitol Records where we have, you know, full orchestra recording at the same time, things like that. With Phil there, Phil Ramone was, of course, very famous producer, done so much in his career. He was more involved in kind of keeping the energy of the session going, keeping things light. He was telling a lot of stories in the control room. Not really, he'd be listening to takes, and he'd sometimes be the one to tell you, yeah, that's it. That's good. That's the take. But ultimately, musically, Barry's process is he'll sketch out arrangements for songs. And then he'll work with an arranger. And he has some great arrangers that he's worked with over the years. A lot of really famous arrangers, Don Sobeski and people like that. And their job is to kind of realize the vision that Barry has of that. So they'll do all the fine points of it. You know, Barry's not going to sit down and orchestrate, for a full orchestra.
Sure.
But he'll write all the lines. He'll write all the lines they're playing, and he'll do all the broad strokes. And if there's one note that's not the way he likes it, he'll go back to the arranger. I think it's a hard job for an arranger because he's had some pretty incredible arrangers who work with him, and Barry will let them know if this isn't exactly the way that he's hearing it. And it can get very dense. There are some pieces of music that are very involved, and Barry is very aware of one note being out of place in it. He's very aware of what's going on in his arrangements.
Well, I got to believe, because I've interviewed a bunch of people who've worked with, for example, Bob Ezrin, and he did like The Wall. And I always wonder, like, is Ezrin telling Gilmore, Dave, that solo just... I don't know how that works, and I guess it's different for different people, but a Gilmore is like a Barry kind of guy. He's freaking David Gilmore. He doesn't have to, I think he knows what notes go where.
Right.
And I always just wonder how that works in that situation. Friendly, I'm sure it's always friendly. I mean, I'm not trying to like stir up adversary.
No, it is. It is. But I think, that comes back to the old thing about how it's no matter who you are, it's difficult to produce yourself. Hmm. No matter how good a player you are, no matter how good a singer you are, it always helps to have kind of a trusted voice in the other room to say, yeah, that's it. You know, to give, you know, it's encouragement. Right. Everyone needs encouragement. If you're performing, everyone needs to, you know, have someone that can tell you if, you know, I think you can do better. Let's do another one.
Sure.
And so you have, so, you know, I'm a producer too, and that's, you know, you kind of learn when to, you know, give a little guidance and when to just step back and let the artist do their thing and, you know that they'll get it without you telling them what to do. So I think it's the same with Barry working with those, you know, working with big producers. Sometimes his records have evolved more out of pretty much him being there, building tracks in his studio at home and kind of filling in things later. So those are almost all his productions, where he may have a producer who kind of puts things together and, you know, helps facilitate a lot of things. But, you know, a lot of times, you know, he's certainly a very capable producer. So,
You've done a lot of work playing in major musicals off Broadway. And I was curious, how is performing on a big play or big musical different than, you know, performing on stage with a band?
It's very different. And it was something I sort of fell into. I've been playing with Barry for a few years, 2 or 3 years. And there's a percussionist named Mike Pfau that played with us during that time. And he had family in the Bay Area up in San Francisco. It's about an hour and a half, 2 hours north of here where I am. And you know, I was kind of going back and forth from San Francisco to L.A. during that time. So he said, there's a musical coming up called Mamma Mia. It's all this ABBA music, and I think we can get on it. Because, and the way we got into it is Barry had been going out and doing all these tours with a core band of, you know, seven guys probably, and then picking up nine horns in each city, in each region. So there's a contractor from Canada who basically had contacts with all the best musicians on every instrument in every city, in every region. So we go to New York, we have New York players for, you know, to go to Pennsylvania and Massachusetts, wherever we are. They kind of travel around with us for a few days. So he
when you
also
say wherever you are, I mean wherever the production is.
Well, no, I'm going back to Barry's.
Oh, just Barry's stuff. Okay, Barry's.
Yeah, yeah. Going to Barry's stuff. So the contractor that did those gigs also contracted a bunch of big musicals. So okay. Mike, my buddy Mike, the percussionist, has said, you know, I think we can get in on this. So I said, okay, well, we'll try it. So Mamma Mia came around, and we did, you know, we were hired for it. We just had to join that specific union and be in it for 6 months before it started, and that kind of qualified us, and we did it. So that was – and fortunately, my first experience in doing the Broadway stuff was a really good one. There was a guitar player named Doug Quinn who was Guitar One, and he had come from New York. He'd been on Broadway. He'd probably done – I think he did 11 years of Les Mis or something on Broadway. He'd done the really long runs. But he was young. You know, he was my age. And he had a great attitude about doing these shows. Even though we're in the pit doing 8 shows a week, he always went in saying, you know I can do a better show on my next one. He's always striving to do that. That's the attitude that really stuck with me, that if you're going to do something that has that much repetition, that you're doing 8 shows, you're in a pit, you're not in front of the audience, that it really becomes more about really, really refining your performance and coming in with the kind of energy that it needs to keep doing that. So there's a lot of super precision in doing Broadway shows that you might not get on a big stage. Even though, I mean, you try to, you know, there's precision in every tour that you do. But after, you know, a performance of a Broadway show, you're going to get notes about you know, the quarter note in bar 833 is, you know, you're playing it just slightly long and slightly
loud. Who do you get those notes from?
The conductor.
Wow.
Conductor notes. And
auditor, a band auditor.
Yeah, no, it's very specific.
Wow.
And so, yeah. And so, you know, Mamma Mia was a lot of fun. I did that. That was when the guys from ABBA were first putting that together, Benny and Bjorn. They came up there and worked with us, and, you know, we got to know those guys, and we had access to all the original tracks that they put these records together with. And, you know, I'd never been a big fan of ABBA before that, but if you listen to how the records are put together, they're pretty intricate productions. So all the parts have to fit together really well. So that was an interesting experience. I did 3 months of that in San Francisco, and then I did 3 months of that in LA. So that was, you know, that was a good long run that kind of fit into maybe between tours with Barry. Then I'd go out and work with Barry again.
So that was like probably what, 6 or 7 days a week, wasn't it?
It's 6 days a week, 8 shows a week. So you have doubles 2 days a week.
Yeah, it's a big
run. It's a lot of shows.
Yeah.
And there was one other time, you know, and so I did several of these. I did, you know, Chicago, which was doing banjo and mandolin mainly. Aida was Elton John's musical, more of a rock show. And then Lion King. And Lion King is probably the most challenging of all of them. That's just really, really challenging music and a lot of doubles. One of the doubles for the guitar chair is a kalimba, actually, and that was some of the hardest stuff playing.
What do you mean a lot of doubles? I'm sorry.
Doubles are the different instruments that you play on a Broadway show. In other words, you get paid more if you play electric guitar plus acoustic guitar.
Sure.
And if you play nylon string guitar, that's a second double. And if you play ukulele, that's another one. And kalimba, in this case, the, you know, African hand drum was, or finger piano, whatever you call it, was another one. So learning those things, that there's a certain amount of work that goes into learning a show like that to get to the point where you can memorize enough of the show so you can actually look at the conductor while the show is going on, because the tempos will change from night to night depending on who's on stage and how fast the dialogue is. A lot of things, a lot of variables. So I'd have to say, even though I started that fairly late in development of my career, that was probably, right around late 30s, around 40 by the time I started doing that. But really learned a lot from that experience of, you know, musically, it really kind of stretches you to do some things that you might not ordinarily do in your everyday music career.
Which is great get paid to base. It's like getting paid for tuition in a sense.
Well, it is. You learn a lot. You're working with very good musicians. A lot of these guys are fantastic musicians in these orchestra pits. I just did, and most of the time it is in the pit. And that's, you know, I didn't have a problem with that. I was fine being down there and not being on stage. There's something that's kind of, you know, it's a very steady thing. You have pretty much your days free to do what you want, do other gigs or whatever it is you're doing. And you come in and you do the show, and it's a very regular thing. It's one of those rare kind of jobs you have as a musician where it's, hey, I have a routine going here. This is what I do. I can count on this. This is what it is. So it's nice in that sense too. This last year, I hadn't done a show for a long time because Barry went through a stretch of 10 or 12 years where we really didn't take more than a couple weeks off at any one time in that whole period. But I had a 7-week period last summer, June and July. And I got called to do a show in San Francisco that was called A Night with Janis Joplin. And it was a really fun show. It ended up working perfectly into my schedule. And that was with a band on stage. And it was at the ACT Theater in San Francisco, which is a very respected theater, great theater company. And There are two guitars and a full band on stage with three horns, I think. And the cast was Casey Clanton did Janis Joplin. She was the lead, and she was amazing. There are three or four other girls that sang that were amazing. And that was a lot of fun. That was really like much more like being in a rock concert every night. Yet it had the kind of precision and everything else that goes along with a usual Broadway show. The difference in this one, though, was you had to memorize all the score and all the underscore and everything because there were no charts on stage. So where in the pit, you're usually, even if you've kind of played it a lot of times, you're still following the chart. Here, it was all committed to memory. So that was a different kind of challenge, but fun.
Did you get to play all the – what was the guy's name? Peter something was her guitarist, I think.
She had a couple of guys, and they were kind of – you know, the two guitars were kind of the parts were spread out more between the two guitars rather than you're this guy and you're the other guy. Mm-hmm. So I listened to all the originals. I listened to all the TV shows that I could listen to, all the old Dick Cavett
appearances. Yeah.
Yeah. And all that stuff. And she had some good players. Yeah. And the guys from Big Brother and the Holding Company, you know, a couple, you know, the guys that are left, or the bass player, I guess, is the guy still around. He was there opening night. So these guys were kind of coming in and checking things out. So it was interesting.
Those
it was different
good players. There were some really good intricate lines there, especially like if you look, I know that the one opening line of Summertime, I think it is.
Right.
Yeah. That's not an easy line. It was pretty creative to come up with that whole, you know, sort of like chromatic, if I remember correctly. And very cool.
It's a very cool part. Yeah. That was, you know, that was one of the things I had to play. And tricky thing about that was, not that it was the hardest thing in the world to play, but memorizing it.
Yeah.
Because every little detail of it had to be perfect to fit in with everything. So.
And it's not a short, like, four bar. It's a pretty it's a lengthy intro, all guitar, man.
It is, and it's different. Each time around, it's a little different. Yeah. So, yeah, that was a memorization workout for sure.
That's cool, man. Well, that's good that you got to do that. Let's talk about gear for a few minutes. Well, actually, let's talk about growing up, and then we'll go switch over to gear. You grew up in California, in Northern California. That's in Pacific Grove. Is that Northern California? I'm sorry. I'm just like an idiot with California stuff, man.
It's technically called the Central Coast of California. So it's the Monterey Bay area. It's where Carmel, Pebble Beach is. If you've ever seen the golf tournaments on, you know, on TV, it's that, right, you know, those really scenic golf courses right on the ocean. It's that area. It's a beautiful area. I went to I went to high school here for 4 years in Pacific Grove, which is right on the water. Small town, had there are quite a few musicians that have come out of this area that are, you know, good musicians. So I had a pretty good, some pretty good role models in that sense coming out of here.
Good childhood.
Yeah, it was great. It was great.
What kind of work did your parents do?
My father's an artist and art professor, and great artist, still around. Both parents are still around. He taught at UCSB in Santa Barbara when I was very little. Until I was about 10 years old, we would stay there. But he would also take sabbaticals and go back to the East Coast. And so we lived in Maine for 3 years, and we went to Europe and I lived in England for part of fourth grade and sixth grade. So he would go and teach there. So he had a very interesting career. My mother was a teacher too for part of that time, and also an artist. But after when I was about 12 or 13, my parents split up, and my mother, being from California, decided that she wasn't going to stay around in Maine. So we came out to California. She had my grandmother lived close to here. We had family in this area, and she had actually lived in Pacific Grove before. So we ended up landing here, and it was kind of just it was a new start. But it turned out to be a pretty great place to be. And so, you know, it was difficult at the time for sure, but pretty cool place to end up if that's going to happen.
Yeah, so, yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, it sounds like you had a lot of good experience too, like living in England. I mean, I think that's like a real – you get a – I don't know. I grew up in New York City, and one of the things I loved about it is I met people from all over the world, and I really enjoyed that because I think I have a better – I don't know, appreciation of that. You know, accents don't scare me, for example. I mean, right. You know, I just think it's good to live with different people and different cultures. It kind of turns you on to new stuff.
Oh, it's great. And as you said, the East Coast is a lot different than California. And so I was happy to have some of that experience living in the East Coast, living, in the Boston area, living up in Maine. You know, having spent time in New York, all those kinds of things were great. And England was great, too. And that's one thing that Barry's done. Barry kind of plays in most states in the U.S. and has huge crowds everywhere here. And then in England, all over the U.K., he's enormously huge. That's, his fans there travel all over to see him. So we go over to England maybe once a year, at the most once every 2 years. So I've spent a lot of time over there. So it is nice to travel over there. Having had a childhood experience there, I think it adds something to that experience.
Hmm. If you've been at this a while, and I was curious if you had to go back and give young Mike advice, let's say Mike in your 20s or 30s, what advice would you have given yourself? And maybe it would have been different advice at different stages. What would that advice have been?
Yeah, that's a tough one because I think, it's easy to kind of fall into a thing where you say, God, if only I had done this, or if only I had, I thought of buying Apple stock when it was $10. anything like that. If you thought of all the things you could have done, of course there are things that you think you could have done differently that would have made a difference. But ultimately, at some point, if you end up in kind of a good place where you're happy with where you are, you're healthy, you can look back and see a lot of that you've had some great experiences, and you continue to have those, then. The other way of looking at it is that everything, including the mistakes that you've made, led to where you are. And it's all part of that. And I don't think there's any way that you can go through a career and have everything work out just perfectly. Hmm. I think that you learn from, things that don't necessarily work out well, and it all comes together. But, that being said, I have a stepson who's a bass player, and he lives back in New Jersey. He's moved back there and kind of making a career for himself. He's 30. And so for the last 10 years, I've tried to, give him advice when I can about what to do. So, we talk about those things. I think about that, about what it is to have a career. I think when you go to music school now, there's more of some kind of interest in teaching kids about the business of music. I think you go to Berkeley now, it's a much different place than when I was there. I think people are teaching people about publishing and writing and, record contracts and all those things that you actually making a career. When I was doing that, there was not much information about those kind of things. So it was really kind of figure it out as you go. And for all of us in that generation, I think, there was, we didn't know a whole lot about, real music business things. We kind of learned as we went. So you learn that along the way. I think the kind of philosophy that you have, or that I had, was that you just take everything that you possibly can. You just say yes to everything and keep busy and, just try that. That's how you do it. At a certain point, you maybe get a little more selective about what you're doing and try to do, try to focus on things that are maybe going to be better in the long run, or end you up in a better place. I think in terms of advice, I'd say it's really important to write music a lot. And it's something that I've done, but I probably would have done more of it at a younger age and kind of got more involved in, you know, trying to be, you know, songwriter, you know, as opposed to the musician. And I would advise all young players to do that, to get, you know, to be a writer, to be, you know, to give yourself a shot at the kind of things that can give you some, you know, kind of long-term income and long-term, you know, involvement in a different part of the industry.
And recurring revenue as far as.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, if you're, and I think that, you know, there was this kind of blind ambition about being a studio guitar player when I was coming up. I don't think that exists in the same way now for young guys coming up, because it's not really as much of an industry as it was. When I, in the 70s, there were guys that you could look to. There was, you know, Larry Carlton. That guy's a studio guitar player.
Right.
That's what he does. Lee Ritenour, that guy's a session guy. These guys, you know, Lukather's coming up. He's a session guy. That's what he does. He plays on all these records. That's a career that you can have if you're good enough. You can be do that. Now, you know, there are a couple of holdovers from that generation. Although none of those guys do sessions. Lukather hasn't done a session in years. And he'll be the first one to tell you that it's not a – he doesn't get any calls to do that. He was one of the – you know, he was playing on 10 records a week that were, you know, number ones. It doesn't exist in the same way that it did at that point. But when I was coming up, that was something you could say, oh, yeah, that's something I can point to. Now, over the course of the, you know, into the 80s and into the 90s, what happened with all those guys that were those top players is that they either branched out and did solo careers, or they became writers and producers like Jay Graydon. I mean, that guy was writing huge hits for Earth, Wind & Fire and things like that. He was a session player, but it wasn't just that. If you're just – you know, there were some old school guys like, you know, Tommy Mottola not Tommy Mottola. Tommy Mottola? Those old guys.
Yeah, he's ass.
Yeah. But those guys for their whole career.
The wrecking
that's
crew.
That's what they did. Yeah. That's what they did. You know, they were, it was like a 9-to-5. It was like a, you know, almost kind of like a sort of blue collar job. They'd go in and they'd be in the studio and they'd do that. And that's what they did. And, you know, so they're guys that kind of did that for their whole lives. But I think a lot of people realize that they're playing all these hits, and the guys that are really successful in that scenario are the guys that are the artists or the songwriters. You know, it's not necessarily the studio musicians. So I think, you know, it's a very ambitious thing to want to be a studio musician. And there are guys that have managed, there are guys that are my age and even younger that have managed to really stay in LA and make that a thing. Guys in Nashville, not too many guys in New York anymore that do that, I don't think. No. But certainly guys in Nashville
and even Muscle Shoals to a lesser extent, but there's not only a small handful of them.
Right. I met some of those guys at the NAMM show a couple of years ago with the Tom Anderson booth and hung out with the guitar player that had done a lot of stuff there. Yeah. There are these little pockets of things that you can do that. And certainly, you know, for me, my time in LA, it was in the 90s. So I was still in on some of that. I was able to have, you know, even though somewhat, certainly very anonymous compared to the Carltons and Lukathers of the world. But, you know, I was busy doing a lot of TV shows. I had TV shows every week. I had young producers that I worked with and who would hire me for everything that they did. Mm. So we were doing movies and TVs, and I was getting a chance to write some cues for things and getting into that. And kind of during the 90s, there was still some of that. So I had that experience, and it was great, and it was challenging, and it was a chance to do really what I had thought was the coolest thing to do in music. You know, I think over a period of time, those things have changed. Now, when I do sessions, it's pretty much me. You know, someone sends me an MP3, and I put tracks on by myself. Sure. I engineer myself, and that's the experience of it. I still do it, but most guys are doing it that way.
Yes. 100%. Well, you got to be a little more fair to yourself, if you don't mind me saying. You said I was not as visible as Lukather and Carlton. Like, nobody except the 99% of the other session musicians were not as visible as those guys, you know? I mean, you can make a really good living as a session player back in the day when you did that. And it, like you said, it's just not around now as much. It's funny, I apologize. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was saying, even in Nashville, a lot of guys are just doing tracks from home.
Sure. Absolutely.
And, you know, you just got a core guys that are kind of like our age group that are holding the fort down, a couple of young guys, but for the most part, it's, you know, it's changed, as you said.
Yeah, it's a different thing. So I think if you're a young player coming up today, that might not be I think some people might still see that and go, yeah, I want to be a session player. You know, the reality of how many of those guys are going to fall into that. I think certainly there are people that are preparing well to do that and are getting very good at a young age at doing that. But, it is a changing world. There's more production that you're doing on your own. There's more you recording your own parts. There's more, I think during that time in the 90s, we saw it go from, 80s into the 90s, going from all analog recording into like the very beginning stages of digital recording where, before that really sequencing, I would have a little small Mac where we were sequencing drum parts and things attached to a reel-to-reel deck with Simpty and recording tracks for TV. I did a bunch of tracks for General Hospital. That was one of the gigs that I did. And that's how we were doing it back at that time. And that kind of slowly, started to turn into actual digital recording. But that whole process now, clearly anyone growing up in the last starting their career in the last 10 or 15 years, it's an all digital world. They're all, that's very much a set platform. So being accomplished at computer work, I think is absolutely something you have to, you have to look at, you have to be good at.
Absolutely, man. Let's talk about gear for a little bit. I can't imagine how many guitars you have after all these years of, do you have any idea how many you have ballpark?
It's, I don't have hundreds of guitars. I have a lot, but it's a couple dozen more than, a couple hundred. I tend to play guitars that work for me and not, I don't have the, million road cases full of exactly the same kind of guitar. But I have, my main guitar is a Tom Anderson Strat drop top. I have been working with Tom for, since the mid-90s. He's an amazing guitar builder, great guy. His guitars are just fantastic, and he's always taken fantastic care of me and hooks me up with, whatever I need on that guitar. And I've used it with Barry since the beginning, really since I started with Barry. So that guitar is just I have a Fender Strat in kind of as a backup for that, but the Anderson is just something, that I can count on to just be perfectly in tune, always sounds good, always does kind of versatile enough to get me through all the electric stuff that I need for the most part, unless I need a real, hollow body or something sound. Anyway, so that's, so I work with, that's kind of a main guitar that I use.
Is there steel frets on that?
Yeah, I'm not sure of the exact, alloy that he put on last time, but they're great.
Yeah, they're really so good. Smooth, man.
Yeah, he did a really nice job. He refretted a couple years ago, so that's great. So on the road, I have that. I have a Godin nylon that I use here and there. I also endorse Taylor guitars, and so I have some really nice Taylor acoustics that are on the road. Tim Godwin at Taylor has always been very cool with, helping me out on the road or TV shows and stuff that I need. So, and I use that, they don't make it anymore, but there's a Taylor Neve preamp that really works well for acoustic guitar. So the acoustic guitar sound is actually a pretty big part of that gig too.
For Barry's gig.
For Barry's gig, yeah. So that's kind of the – those instruments are on the road all the time. I don't really have those at home. But I have Strats and Tellys and things at home, and I have – 63-335 that I used to use a lot. I used that all, you know, kind of in the 80s and, you know, probably most of the 80s I really played that as my main guitar. And it's a great guitar. It still is. I don't play it as much. I don't take it out on gigs as much. It's kind of, you know, just one of those things. I don't want it to get knocked off the stand. But
or lifted, man. That's a...
Yeah, it's a... Yeah, it's a beautiful guitar though, and it plays great. And you know, I record with it, and still play it. You know, occasionally if I do a solo gig or something with my band, I'll break it out and use it.
What kind of pickups are there? Is it the original stock pickups?
They're not the originals, but they were changed in the 60s. So they're still 60s Gibson pickups. They're just not the original PAFs, I think. So
they must sound wonderful though, man.
Yeah, they were. I had them redone and by the guys at Valley Arts in L.A. back, you know, a long time ago, back in the 80s, early 80s, when they had, you know, when they were the guys that did everything, did all Larry's guitars and all that. So, yeah, it's a great guitar, great sounding guitar.
Any cool stories behind how you got that one?
Well, I had a friend. I was in high school. I had a friend who I think just graduated from high school, was also kind of – is a really talented guitar player, a guy named Marco Savo, lived up in the Pacific Northwest. Now he's up there, and he has kind of become really great – I don't know what you call it. It's almost like kind of swing. There's this kind of – not Western swing, but kind of like a blues swing guitar player. Anyways, he's amazing at it. It's not really something that I'm good at, but he's great at it. And anyway, he had this guitar and he was going to sell it. And I bought it for $375. I remember that. And
oh my God. And for the 63, 335.
And yeah, wow. And it's been, and so the only story I have about that is that it, probably about 83 or something. I came home from a gig and I had it, and my girlfriend at the time had had too much to drink, so I carried her into the house. I get a phone call at 4 a.m. saying, from my mother, saying, "Mike, do you know where your guitar is?" And I said, "I don't know. I brought it in." And she said, "Well, someone just called me, and you left your guitar in the street, and the guy across the street picked it up, and he's got it there." So
wow.
I walked across the street, this guy hands me my 335 back, and I set it down to carry my girlfriend in, and was very lucky to get it back. So I'm pretty careful with it now.
You must have had some good karma that you previously put out there, man.
Yeah, and it had, and the only reason that I had my name on it, and my mother happened to be the only Lent in the phone book, so he looked up her name
wasn't
in
even
the phone
a, it
book.
Wasn't even a
I didn't have my phone number on there.
Holy crap.
He took the time to look it up and call her, and she called me, and that's how I got it back. So,
well, hold on a second.
Anyway.
For you millennials, a phone book is something that...
Exactly. And I didn't have a cell phone then either.
It's something that you used to get delivered.
That's right.
Well, that's
you had
a cool
to be home to get a phone call.
Yeah, man. How wild is that? Desert Island Discs, in no particular order, and knowing that this can change tomorrow, what would be the first three CDs that – I can't even say CDs anymore. What do I call them?
Yeah.
The first three
– I know. It's kind of the age of picking single songs out of many different albums and making your own album out of that. It's the format is definitely changed. That, you know, that's a good question. I think that changes. I think there's certain things that I gravitate toward. Picking three is difficult because I think that there are different things that I would listen to at different times. But, you know, some of my favorite records to listen to are Pat Metheny's records. Mm-hmm. I think they're just beautifully recorded and engineered. Something like Secret Story or We Live Here, one of those. You know, those are great albums that I listen to a lot. I think that, you know, I listen to them a lot just because I think I find the music is kind of uplifting. It's not depressing. It's not overly, you know, just technical. It's just, you know, it's just great produced and engineered and played music. So I like that. Probably something by James Taylor, maybe the Gorilla album from a long time ago. I'm a big James Taylor fan, big fan of his guitar playing actually too. And so something there, and maybe, you know, if I'm staying with, you know, my love of jazz guitar, probably Smoking at the Half Note by Wes Montgomery. That's something that I still dip into. I'm actually transcribing one of the solos that I never got to now, and it's still fun. It's still amazing.
That's cool, man. What's something, Mike, that you've learned about yourself on this long journey you've been on?
Well, you know, that's a deep question. It's a tough question. I think that if there's something that, you know, that I'm happy about that I've done, is that I've really, you know, I've kind of stuck in there with something that I really love. I've been very dedicated to being a musician, and that hasn't changed at all. It's not, you know, certainly not something that, I mean, I knew I was dedicated at a young age, but I've had that. It's a lifelong thing for me. I don't think that that's necessarily the case with everyone that gets into music or has talent in music. So, you know, for me, it's kind of, you know, seeing I've been able to see the benefits of really being dedicated to something and seeing that as a lifelong thing. There's no beginning point, there's no end point to it. There's not ever a point where I'm going to say, yeah, I'm satisfied with where I am and what I've done. I think it's always, you know, that you have to kind of just keep going, and think good things will happen if you do that.
So with that in mind, let me ask you this then. What is it you get emotionally out of this guitar thing that allows, you know, that keeps that dedication afloat? Because, you know, there's good times, bad times, you know, and I think there has to be something in it for you. You're not doing it because you like the way the instrument looks, you know, because it's, you know, the highest paying job in the world. What's the drive there for you?
I think it all has to do with the music. I think that really to be a musician and to be that for life, it can't even really be a choice. You can't be someone who goes, you know, I'm going to decide to be a musician. I think you almost have to have no choice. And the people that I know that are still doing it and that are the people that I look up to and the people that are my peers are the people who there's no question about what they're going to do with their life. This is it. They're in it for the long haul. And, you know, they're going to keep doing it, as long as they're around. It's going to be something that they keep focusing on and keep wanting to get better. I think the rewards are, I think that if you look at just playing a show or playing a gig, and it could be any kind of gig, I think there are a few moments during that whole gig that are the moments that really make it something really special. I think most of the time it's the process of doing it is essentially enjoyable, that you can be feeling like you're playing well, but if you're improvising, if you're, you know, playing solos, if you're playing good rhythm parts, there are a few moments that could last, you know, 15 seconds where things really gel and something really special happens. Those kind of moments, even though they're brief, are the ones that really, I think, really sustain you in the long run, because those are amazing things that happen. But along the way, I think you get enjoyment from being dedicated to a craft and being able to, you know, kind of perform at a level that you feel comfortable with. I think there is the pursuit of getting better is something that keeps you going too. For me, that is. I always feel like, you know, there's a lot of stuff that I can get better at. And that's one thing that really keeps me going.
Thank you for answering that. That's a tough question. I appreciate your answering so honestly. That last thing you mentioned, the pursuit of getting better keeps you going. I feel the same way about like various business things I'm in, and it's a weird thing. I don't know. It's like going to the gym almost, which I also do. It's like it's an isolated thing in a way. It's like because the only, and that right. measurement is in our own heads, which is what's really weird. Like getting better according to us, but like the guys that are, you know, really like sort of the type A people in general. And I'm sure you're like, doesn't your bar, like you get better, but then you get another bar because you want to get more better, quote unquote, you know?
It's a funny Absolutely.
Thing. It's a really funny thing. Tell me something about yourself people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd.
I don't know about, let's see, that's a tough question. Well, the other thing that I'm really involved with is being a tennis player. So people cool. might not know I'm do that, but I'm really dedicated to that. It's something that I spend a lot of time working on, and I have the same kind of feeling about that. I'm always still trying to get better, but I was a junior tennis player and kind of, you know, dropped out of it a bit while I was really, really heavily pursuing the career. But, you know, for the last 10 or 15 years, I've been back into it and very serious about that. So people might not know that, but it's something that is way up there in importance to me.
Cool.
And something that I think is a really good balance between, you know, the musician kind of lifestyle and the travel and all that. And it really helps balance that out and kind of keep healthy mind and body.
Well, not only that, you talk about, yeah, the health component. I mean, you get to our age, man, you look at some of the people that you grew up with and you're like, wow, like when did you stop giving a shit about yourself? You know, and it's just yeah. like, you know, you have energy when you were, I don't know about you, but I'm definitely a hell of a lot more energetic than because I do stuff like that and I work out and like, you know, I never think about the thought of like, oh, I can't do that physically, whether it's like going hiking or going to an event or just hanging out with my kids, that never enters my mind, and I'd feel horrible if it did.
Yeah.
You know?
No, it's really important. And I think you can stay feeling fantastic and keep feeling better in your life if you have something like that that you're dedicated to also.
Yeah, totally.
So for me, it is. I feel better than or as good or better than I ever have. So
yeah, I agree with you.
I don't feel declining, which is nice because as you said, we see people that, you know, aren't in the best shape. So, it's important.
Yeah. It's tragic, man. Well, yeah. Anyway, do you have any non-musical superpowers?
Superpowers? Well, I don't know. I don't know that I have any superpowers at all. So, I'd go back to tennis. That's the thing that is really my other thing that I'm really dedicated to and that I feel like I can do at a pretty high level. So,
I'm just ask you two more questions, man. I really appreciate your time. What's the toughest decision that you ever had to make or the hardest thing you ever had to do?
Well, that's a tough question. You know, there are a lot of things, you know, certainly if you've ever been through a divorce, I think that's probably as difficult as it gets. And, you know, I had to make that decision, several years ago, and it's there's nothing harder than that, especially when you're the one who's kind of, you know, forcing that decision. So, which I was, so that, you know, certainly that's it. It's not easy, and it's life changing. And you know, I've been fortunate to come out of it, and You know, I'm married to a wonderful woman. My wife, Debbie, is absolutely fantastic, and we are super happy, and it's a great thing. But, you know, sometimes getting to that point can be very difficult.
Yeah, I have been through divorce, and it is tough because it's like even getting married, there's no manual for it. Raising kids, there's no manual for it. But unwinding any of those things, it's not a natural process. It's a very, very unnatural process. So, I have been there for sure.
No, it was, you know, and you have to be able to take – you know, way that there were positive things that came out of it and, you know, and look at good things, but also, you know, you have to deal with some pretty difficult stuff. So, yeah, it's hard.
For sure, man. And the last question, Mike, what's been the biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years and how much of this has been deliberate and how much is just a part of aging?
Well, the last 10 years has been really the time that I've been with my wife, Debbie. And she's probably, well, without question, is much more outgoing than I am. So I think that's been, you know, kind of opened me up a lot personality-wise. And I think in general, I'm quite a bit more social with it than I tend to be on my own. And I think they're not drastic changes. I think I'm still essentially the same, but, I think I'm probably a lot more open to, being out there in the world and being happy with her. So
good for you, man. Well, I'll tell you what, if you are the slightest bit uncomfortable, I would have never known. And these questions are difficult, some of them, so I appreciate it. I would have never known that, so keep whatever you're doing is working, or you're a great bullshitter, one of the two. Hey man, I want to talk about a couple of things you have going on right now. I know you're doing some production work. Where can people listen to some of that? I know you have Al Jardine's single, and you have another artist that you produced an album. Want to talk about that for a little bit?
Actually, my wife Debbie wrote a Christmas song, and we've been talking with Al about doing a Christmas album for a few years, and so we came up with some ideas, and it hasn't turned into an album yet, but we did release a single right before Christmas this last year, and we're really going to push it much more this year and get a real proper release out of it. It's called Sunshine to Snowflakes. Sunshine to Snowflakes. It's on iTunes and all those other outlets, Amazon, etc., as a download. And, again, it's a Christmas song, so it's not going to come up as being relevant for a little while yet this year, but we're going to push that a lot. It was a blast to do that. And Al sounds great. Had a lot of great players on it. A lot of the guys from the Manilow Band, we were sending tracks all over New York, LA, all over Vegas. That guy's playing on it all over. His son sings a background. His son, who's also been out on the road with Brian Wilson for the last few years, they've been doing that together. Al and Brian have been touring doing the Pet Sounds concerts, which is an amazing band. And
they opened up. I saw this was the weirdest concert. Jeff Beck.
Oh, Jeff was doing gigs with him. Yeah,
opened up. I was with my son there. I was like, this is a weird combination.
I know. Al told me, he goes, oh, yeah, do you know this guy, Jeff Beck? And I'm like, I know this guy, Jeff Beck.
A little. I've heard of him.
Yeah, he goes, oh, yeah, he's quite a guitar player, isn't he? Yeah.
Just a bit.
So we have that. And then I'm in the process of finishing up producing a record for an artist named Linda Arceo, who's a singer-songwriter from the Central Coast here in California. And got a lot of great players on that, and it's been a lot of fun. Also, she's a guitar player. She played a lot of acoustic guitar on it. I played a lot of acoustic guitar. I play some electric. Mainly arranging and producing, is the big part there. I play when I have to, but I've also brought another guitar player named Tom Ayers, who's fantastic and very different from me, and got some great performances out of him. So we're kind of finishing that up. Got a few tracks to put on, but it's getting down to the wire. So that'll be coming out this in the next couple of months.
Awesome. And it's Arceo, A-R-C-E-O?
A-R-C-E-O, Linda Arceo, yeah.
And what kind of music is that?
Well, she's you know, she's an acoustic guitar player, singer, songwriter, you know, it ventures into rock, a little bit into, you know, slightly country edge of rock a little bit, but, you know, a lot of cool tunes. There's some, you know, I wouldn't say it goes as far as really to being in jazz, but, you know, little sort of, you know, some, you know, some quieter stuff with, you know, acoustic piano and guitar and a lot of instruments like that. A little bit of Latin stuff in there too, but nice combination of stuff and just good strong songs.
So like maybe contemporary pop? Is that a beat?
Yeah, sure.
Cool. Everybody check that out, and that'll be out in the summertime or late summer?
We're looking for, I think an August release.
Awesome. So check it out. It's Linda Arceo, A-R-C-E-O, and Mike produced the record. And check out Al Jardine's Christmas single that Mike did. Mike's wife wrote. It's called Sunshine to Snowflakes.
And one of these days, I'm getting my solo album out. So good. I'll let you know.
Good. I would love to promote it, man. So that's awesome. Listen, I can't thank you enough for your time, and I really appreciate it. You're a super cool guy, and been real nice getting to know you. Is there any final words of wisdom?
You know, just keep doing it. If you love music, it's something you just have to stick with. And as you said, things can go up and down. You know, a lot of good things can happen if you stick with it. I've had a really wonderful career. I've been able to travel all over the world and meet really quite a few of my heroes, a lot of my guitar heroes, a lot of, you know, music heroes. And, if you stick with things, good things can happen.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate it, Mike. Everyone, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Thanks again to Mike Lent for spending time with us. Please check him out, his projects. Linda Arceo is an album he's producing. It'll be out this summertime. It's contemporary pop. And check out the Al Jardine single he produced that his wife actually wrote. It's called Sunshine to Snowflakes. And then send him a Christmas thank you after you listen to it, if you can find him online. go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get notified about future episodes along with early product announcements and discounts. And remember, happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have some fun. Till next time, peace and love, and I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.